for and the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. The first case for oral argument this morning is Twin City Fire Insurance Appellant versus Timothy Andrews Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Francis Maloney III from Portland, Oregon. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Jason Smiley, from attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Mark Keane, attorney from Rapid City, and Mr. Gary Jensen, an attorney from Rapid City, and Mr. Scott Armstrong, an attorney from Rapid City. And I understand that, Mr. Keane, you'll be presenting this morning?
Yes.
What?
Colin.
Okay, well, that's good. Okay, I believe we're ready to proceed, and Mr. Maloney, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. This is an intermediate appeal from a discovery order applying a blanket waiver of the attorney-client privilege to approximately 200 insurance claim files. And Twin City is seeking an order from the court overturning in a ruling that as a matter of law there was not an implied waiver of the attorney-client privilege.
Is there anything in the record that we could base that ruling on as far as implied waiver?
Yes and no. Yes, there is something for the court to base a ruling on that there was no waiver. No, that there's nothing before the court as far as factual findings about what was in the claim in the file, because there was no in-camera review that we know of by the trial court.
And I suppose we granted intermediate appeal on this, didn't we?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So to properly consider the current dispute, I'd first ask the court to look at the original relationships between the parties that gave rise to the original communications. Twin City is a workers' comp insurer for RIDCO. Mr. Andrews was an employee of RIDCO who was injured on the job in 2005. Mr. Andrews filed a Department of Labor proceeding against both RIDCO and Twin City. So Twin City had no choice. It hired an attorney to represent both itself and RIDCO. So while that proceeding was still underway before the Department of Labor, the Twin City was sued by Mr. Andrews in Pennington County. Again, Mr. Andrews brought suit against both RIDCO and Twin City. Now, the timeline of events that kind of got us where we're at today started in May 2012 when Mr. Andrews served a request for production. There's two categories of documents at issues. The first category is the Andrews claim notes itself. The claim notes are an electronic, kind of like a diary, a chronological diary entry that the adjuster makes in handling the claim. So when a substantive event, something occurs, the adjuster will get in the computer and make a chronological, contemporaneously kept notes. This includes things that are happening in the file, including communications from his or her attorney in the underlying claim and in the subsequent litigation. The second group of documents were 199 other claim files from years before involving what was called the Large Loss Initiative, what the plaintiff referred, or what Andrews refers to as the $1 million list. And what that was an initiative by Twin City and Hartford to give extra attention and try to settle the really big workers' comp claims.
Was the underlying file here ever part of that $1 million list?
No, it was not. So when Twin City received the discovery request for the 199 files, it objected, did not produce them. When it received the request for the Andrews claim file, it produced that in a redacted form with the attorney-client privileges redacted. In November 2012, plaintiff Andrews filed a motion to compel the Andrews, the attorney-client communications in the Andrews file, and the 199 other claim files. That hearing was in February 2013. And at that time, the trial court ordered the Andrews file to be produced for an in-camera review, and it ordered the 199 other files to be produced. The parties were waiting for findings from the court from the in-camera review. After a few months, there was no word, so the parties asked for a status conference, which occurred in May 2012. And at that time, the court essentially reiterated what is the black letter law for the attorney-client privilege, that if it is a communication communicating factual, summarizing facts that occurred, it's not privilege, it should be produced. If it is a communication from the attorney providing a legal analysis or opinion, it's privilege, it should not be produced, it should be redacted. So based upon that guidance, Twin City redacted the 199 other claim files and produced those in July 2013. And it also went back and unredacted a large portion of the original redactions from the Andrews claim and reproduced those. So in October 2013, the plaintiff files the second motion to compel, and at this time seeks argues that there's been an implied waiver of all attorney-client communications in both the Andrews claim file and the notes in the 199 other claim notes.
Was that the first time implied waiver was raised?
The implied, I believe the implied waiver was argued previously in February 2012, but no, there have been no factual findings, and that was what the in-camera review was ordered as a result of, Your Honor.
Mr. Miller, before we, how did the issue of attorney-client privilege get raised? Did you make that an issue as a defense in this case?
No, Your Honor, we did not.
You didn't plead that you were relying on attorney's advice?
No, Twin City
so
did
how
not.
Did it come up?
Because Twin City denied bad faith. It was simply a denial of bad faith. And that's been one of my frustrations in this proceeding, is that from the very beginning, you know, there's the factors under the Bertelsen case that there has to be an affirmative injection of that issue into the litigation. And we have repeatedly requested at all the different levels, what have we done to inject this into the litigation other than just simply deny the bad faith? And to this day, we haven't received any identification of that. There's been no finding on the record. And to be clear, that despite the age of this case, it's an old case, it's barely along. All we've done are the pleadings, and there's no affirmative defense for advice of counsel. There's been 100 and some discovery requests, but none of those, including the answers to the interrogatories, respond or rely upon advice of counsel. And there's been no deposition, so there's been no testimony or even an affidavit from anyone saying I relied upon advice of counsel in doing this. And if you think about it, as to the 199 other claim files, these files, I mean, the large loss initiative ended in either 2000 or 2002, it was years before Mr. Andrews was even injured.
But somehow that, didn't that delegation of claims handling somehow got into this.
Well, that
somewhere along the line, I'm not sure where.
I'm not sure where either. That's an argument that has been made by Andrews. And that argument states that it's hard to articulate it other than the fact that because there's redactions in the claim file, Twin City therefore, ergo, must have delegated the claims handling to its attorney. It's a presumption. It is a speculative argument that is not based upon any knowledge of the redactions themselves and not based upon any finding or in-camera review by the trial court. At the second motion to compel hearing, Twin City again offered and requested that the court review the Andrews claim file. It had had it for approximately 9 months at that time. The court did not do so and ruled that there was an implied waiver of both the Andrews claim file and the 199 other claim files. A blanket waiver. Everything had to be produced. A week later, November 12, 2013, Twin City filed a motion to reconsider. Now, this was before the order was ever entered granting the motion to compel. Twin City filed a motion to reconsider, asking the court to not only review the Andrews claim file, but listen, we want you to review the 199 other claim files, too. It's very voluminous. We'd like to submit a CD of that. And if the court denies that, we would ask the trial court to accept the documents, the disputed documents under seal for an intermediate appeal so that this court, pursuant to a de novo review, could actually look at the records. The trial court denied all three of those requests at the time of the November 14th order and then the December 3rd, 2013 hearing and order on the motion to reconsider. So it is those two orders that Twin City is appealing in this intermediate appeal.
Now, I got the feeling I didn't see it overt.
I'm sorry?
I didn't see overt evidence, but I got the feeling from reading this file that the trial court was frustrated at maybe towards the end here that perhaps you had not been forthcoming quickly enough in producing things, and the court was sticking by its prior ruling because you hadn't done something in time. Explain that.
I got that feeling too, quite frankly, and I don't know why the court would have felt that way about the Andrews claim file, because the court had had that for 9 months at that point. I don't know. As to the 199 other claim files, I believe that frustration was expressed at the December 3rd hearing after Twin City had requested that those be reviewed. And I think the comment in the appendix was that by the trial court is that I'm denying it. I don't think the Supreme Court can tell what I've done here, and I'm just going to deny and find that there's been an implied waiver. So I don't know where that frustration came from. The materials had been offered to the court. Had been requested on numerous occasions,
when did you offer the unredacted 199 files to the court? Was that at the hearing to produce, or was that at the hearing to reconsider?
That was made in the motion to reconsider, which was seven. It was in between those two. Okay. So the hearing, the oral ruling was at the November 5th motion to compel hearing. Okay.
So did you waive it there's a concern here that there's a waiver because you didn't offer to have the court look at these records at the initial hearing. You only offered it after the court ruled against you and in your motion to reconsider.
Is that
not a waiver?
I don't think so, Your Honor. a waiver would have to be an intentional relinquishment. I don't think there is anything in the record indicating that was an intentional relinquishment. And I think that if you take a look at the November 12th motion to reconsider, it's only a 3 or 4 page motion. And it quite frankly puts out to the trial court that, hey, you know, we've had the Andrews claim file. We don't know whether you need to have the 199 other files because, I mean, it's literally 12 banker boxes of documents, but to the extent you do, we want to get that opportunity in front of you so you could do that because this is required under Bertelsen. And in fact, if you go to the December 3rd hearing, the parties, it's at Appendix 47, 50, and 51. The parties had actually agreed. We'd agreed to have a hearing, and we were walking towards having a hearing where both parties sit down with the court and all the records and go through all this. And then it got scuttled at the end because of the timing. The entry had already, the time for appealing it had already begun to run. And the plaintiff objected to having any hearing that would preserve the right to appeal. So we had to go forward with the appeal. To get back to your question, though, about the necessity of having the documents before the court and the frustration the court may have felt on that. In addition to having those records before the court, having those actually before the court, I would argue to the court that particularly as to the 199 other files, there would not need to be an opportunity to review those because, recall, in the Bertelsen case, the court set out three elements for an implied waiver. The first is that there has to be an affirmative act of injecting the issue into the case, and that the second, that the issue then has to become relevant. Okay, and then third, that the application of the privilege would deny the other party of vital information. Those are the three considerations in Bertel, plus there's additional three kind of guiding principles. But if you think about it, there'd been no affirmative act injecting that issue into it. Setting aside whether the 199 other files were relevant, there had been certainly no injection of the attorney-client privilege from those 199 other files into the litigation. So I would argue that as a matter of law, there does not need to be an in-camera review of those materials because the first two prongs of Bertelsen had not been met. As a practical matter, you need to have those met before you even have a need to review them in camera. Finally, the third argument on that, Your Honors, is that keep in mind, even at this date, nobody has ever disputed the fact that the communications that were redacted were protected and privileged attorney-client communications. So to that effect, Twin City had met its burden of proving that the documents were protected by the privilege. The burden has now switched to the plaintiff, to Andrews, to show that the implied waiver, DM&E versus Acuity, makes clear that the burden of showing that there's been an implied waiver is upon the party seeking to get those documents. So I would argue to the court that under that scenario, it should be incumbent upon the party with the burden of proof to make sure that those documents are put in front of the court for review.
Where are the documents today in the courthouse in Rapid City?
No, well, the Andrews file is. The documents, the 199 other documents, are on a CD in my office and in 12 banker boxes in my office. We asked to submit those under seal to the court, and the court denied that request.
But you made that offer at the reconsideration hearing?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. And you'd be willing to produce them today?
I'm sorry?
You'd be willing to produce them today to the court for an in-camera inspection?
Yes. To this court or obviously both courts, yes. So
if it goes back, what is it that you want when it goes back?
I'm sorry?
What is it? What relief do you want if this goes back?
I was thinking that beforehand, and I think that there's three possible remedies. The first remedy, and frankly what I think would be the most appropriate and what I would, my primary request of this court, is that the court make a ruling as a matter of law, based on the record before it, that there's been no implied waiver of the attorney-client privilege, at least at this stage in the proceedings. Keep in mind, you know, there could be an implied waiver later on. That just hasn't occurred yet. There's been no, and that's based upon the finding as a matter of law that there's been no injection of the issue into the proceedings. The second remedy, Your Honor, would be that if that the court overturn the court's denial of our motion to submit the documents under seal for de novo review of this court, and that this court conduct that review as part of its de novo.
Wait a minute. What court? Us?
That as part of the de novo review. I understand and realize the format, the practical effect of that request. But yes, that would be a remedy.
Well, that would be micromanaging, wouldn't it? Though, I mean, that's really the trial court's job. If we,
I think so. But that would be my client's secondary request.
Right. So, are these in the alternative, or do you want all three?
No, in the alternative.
All right.
In the alternative.
So let's go to three.
And the third alternative The third alternative, which is, I think, the remedy that Justice Severson was getting at, is overruling or overturning the trial court's ruling on the that there has been an implied waiver or a blanket waiver and remand it for in-camera review and factual findings pursuant to Acuity, Bertelsen, Mahoney, and the many other cases.
And so would those be findings as to specifically the existence or non-existence of waiver, or would it be as to the existence of the attorney-client privilege, or exactly what kind of findings?
Well, I think that the trial court would need to follow the six steps set out in Bertelsen, that first a finding of whether there has been an affirmative injection of the issues into the litigation. Second, whether it's relevant.
And if we don't get beyond that, there isn't any in-camera review, is there?
Exactly, which is why my first remedy is a ruling from this court as a matter of law. And I believe I'm 20 seconds from being out of time if there's any other questions.
I guess not, counsel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, you have 20 minutes, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. We are here today for two reasons. First, the Hartford made a tactical decision to not offer the other claim log documents for in-camera review on a timely basis. Second, they alleged in their petition for intermediate appeal that they had made such an offer and the trial court refused it. That would be a big deal if the trial court ignored the procedures set forth in DM&E and Arnoldi. But it didn't. The motion that leads up to the November hearing is their opposition to our motion to compel, no offer. In their filings, they allege that they asked for it during the November 5th hearing. They did not.
Ask for what, counsel?
Did not ask that they offered the 199 claim files up for in-camera review at that hearing. They didn't. Counsel specifically limited the offer to the Timothy Andrews logs, which the trial court had reviewed in the spring of 2013.
Let's go back. Before you get to that at all, there has to be affirmatively making the issue of attorney-client under Bertelsen. It has to be affirmatively pled or in some way made an issue. What did they do to make the privileged communication an issue?
That was briefed on a number of occasions. The appendix is filled with those briefs. The substance of that briefing went to the fact that the Hartford has made a practice of embedding attorney-client communications in the activity logs so that the actual decisions, the denials or terminations of benefits, cannot be determined from the claim file. Counsel repeatedly talks about implied waiver. There is language in Bertelsen that fits this situation. DM&E,
did they claim attorney-client privilege as an affirmative defense?
In the discovery process, when we asked to have them turned over with the redactions restored.
No, I'm talking about in the main action. You pled bad faith, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Did they affirmatively allege that it wasn't bad faith because they were relying on advice of counsel?
No, they did not.
So how do we get beyond that?
We get there because the purpose of the claim file is to document the claim handling decisions, the denials, the terminations, the bases thereof. A plaintiff in a bad faith action has to establish the elements of a wrongful decision and reckless disregard of that fact. The essential document for determining the grounds for a claim handling decision is the claim file broadly and the activity log more specifically. That log, under 58.3-7.4, is supposed to lay out enough information from which one can reconstruct claim handling activities. The redactions prevent anyone from being able to do that in the form that they have been produced.
So did the trial court? I didn't see findings of fact and conclusions of law in any of this. Other than the dialogue that I see, the oral pronouncement saying, yeah, I take it was an implied waiver that the court relied on.
The June 10 order is the closest thing to findings of fact. The June 10 order was issued by the trial court on this issue, specifically as it regarded activity logs. The order is fairly detailed. It's in the first few pages of our brief. It discusses under the heading of both DM&E and Bertelsen why the trial court determined that redactions that would prevent plaintiff from being able to determine the bases of the claim handling decisions needed to be restored. At that stage, the Hartford was given the latitude to go back and go ahead and make a review and determine which ones.
And they did that.
Excuse me?
And they did that, as I understand.
They did that. They said they did that. However, the activity logs that were produced.
So then are there findings after they did that?
No. No other.
Well, then how can we review this case? I mean,
I don't know. I did not bring it to this court for review. We received an order. It was, as the trial court said, and I think the trial court's words were a little misconstrued previously, on the motion to reconsider, when the Hartford finally offered the other claim logs for in-camera review, the trial court said, with no privilege log, which was never turned over to the court, I don't see that the Supreme Court has anything they can review at this point. The trial court wasn't admitting that it made a mistake. It wasn't blaming plaintiff. It was saying that it was up to the Hartford. DM&E and Arnoldi both make it clear that the burden is on the litigant to make that choice. There's good reasons why somebody might not want to turn over the documents for in-camera review while arguing attorney-client privilege. It's a tactical decision.
Well, what about Twin Cities' claim that a privilege log wasn't necessary because they did it in electronic format that was the equivalent of a privilege log?
That's what they did with the Timothy Andrews log back in the spring of 2013, leading up to the June 10, 2013 order regarding the Andrews log and the directive from the trial court that the Hartford should use the same standards in determining what redactions should be restored to the 199 other claims.
Well, counsel, an attorney or insurance company is entitled to rely on privileged advice from their attorney, are they not?
Yes, they are.
Unless it's waived.
They can rely on it, but when you take that advice, couch your claim handling decision in that advice, embed the whole thing into the activity log, and then redact it out, you've left the plaintiff in a bad faith action with absolutely no evidence upon which to be able to specify what they did.
Well, just because it's convenient for a plaintiff doesn't mean it waives a privilege.
No, but it does render the claim file ineffective for its intended purpose. And so, again, I think...
What case law are you relying on?
DM&E and the reasoning behind Bertelsen. Counsel would rely on Bertelsen and the notion of implied waiver. DM&E, on the other hand, says, in a very similar situation, where a company delegates the claim handling to its attorney, it is not a waiver. It is outside the scope of the privilege.
All right. That dealt with DM&E with the attorney doing the fact-finding. And is there any evidence of that in this case?
What there is evidence of is that the claim handling decisions, which articulate the facts upon which the decisions were made, are interwoven with attorney-client communications and then redacted out. It doesn't have to be that way. You can build a claim file without mixing your advice with your statement of your action. As a claim handler, you could say, I called Attorney Bob, and he gave me this advice, entry one. Entry two, I determined to deny the claim because it was untimely. The advice might have been that it was untimely, but the decision is a separate matter. And even if you choose to put them into the same claim file entry, You could redact out the part that deals with Attorney Bob without having to redact out entire chunks of material. Going back to one of the points, was the issue briefed? Was the court made aware of what the claim files look like in their supposedly restored form? Yes. In September, October, we filed briefs that quoted under each heading for Timothy Andrews, whose claims were denied. You know, the DOL determined a variety of claims for benefits were wrongfully denied. We took those parts of the claim file and explained why the issue of why they made the determination was completely invisible based on the redactions. We then took the particular other claim log that is most tightly tied to this case, the Hammonds one, and showed how for a several-month period during which a number of claim handling decisions were being made, the entirety, page after page, is black redaction boxes. In our mind, that plainly results in a claim file produced that does not meet the requirements of 58-3-7.4 because one cannot reconstruct the claim handling activities.
How do you get from the Andrews case to a waiver on 199 other cases on attorney-client privilege?
We do not get to a waiver. Again, that's Bertelsmann language. That's been the Hartford's argument. Bertelsmann and DM.
Well, it was my question. It's not theirs.
In answer to your question, we don't get to waiver so much as what we get to first is the notion of we don't know whether they waived because we don't have the communications, but the redactions are blocking anyone from determining whether or not advice was used and impliedly waived. With regard to the 199 other claim logs, it's not a waiver issue, it's a 404B issue. Counsel discusses this as if we were somehow in the middle of a hypothetical bad faith diversity-based class action in which each of these claims is being litigated. We're simply arguing that the standard is the same for the other claims as it should be for the Timothy Andrews file.
So if this is 404B, how do you connect up the 199 files with yours?
The million-dollar list program. Counsel indicated that the Andrews log or the Andrews claim is not part of the million-dollar list program. We provided the trial court with an awful lot of documentation and argument to suggest that it is based on what we've got so far, despite where they are in terms of their position on it. Ultimately, it was brought up in the briefing to this court that these documents are largely our view of the world. Well, is a appellate court, a Supreme Court in this situation, reviews a record. And the record that was made certainly supports our claim of a connection. At least it did in the trial court's mind.
What's your objection to having the trial court do an in-camera inspection?
The in-camera review after the matter has been litigated, we did not have an objection to the trial court doing it at the time. But once the Hartford elects to litigate this issue to completion. They didn't get ambushed in November. We'd been briefing this and having hearings on it for months. Once they litigate it to completion and the trial court says, well, apparently you're not going to offer these documents up. You're not going to give me a privilege log. I've got what they've given me. I believe that the redactions need to be restored. You've got a certain point. Now, that's the procedure that we've laid out in Arnoldi, in DM&E. Procedurally, we have a one-step process, and so does everybody else. To ask the trial court to go back and do it over is to add another layer. It's basically to give litigants such as the Hartford a get-out-of-jail-free card and add a second step. Litigate it to completion, and then if you lose, demand an in-camera review, the review you could have asked for earlier. That's a two-step process, and it adds uncertainty, difficulty, and delay to litigants. It makes the first step absolutely useless. We have to pound our head against a wall while they sit on their hands. That is the harm that would come from ordering the trial court to conduct that review. Similarly.
Let me ask you this. Is it true, Twin City alleges in the brief, that the trial court's decision was basically made on three hand-selected pages of heavily redacted notes from the Hammonds claim file. Is that true?
No.
Explain that.
The only claim file notes the trial court saw on the other claims were the three pages we waived. That's true. That's three more pages than they provided the trial court. However, the trial court's decision was based on this matter's been litigated for years.
Three pages you waived. It's not your privilege. So, I mean, what are those? You said those three pages we waived.
The three pages that are under discussion were redacted pages where we were able to sort of triangulate, similarly with the Timothy Andrews claim, his log pages. We were able to show, look, clearly they're saying they made a decision to deny during this two-week period. Clearly they've redacted out anything that would suggest why they made the denial. In the Andrews case and in the Hammonds case, there's a lot of indirect evidence regarding what must have happened and what decisions had to be made during that period. And so, again, we did not have any of the unredacted pages available.
Was the Andrews case or the Andrews claim file reviewed by the trial court in camera?
Yes.
And was there a decision based on that?
There was a decision made on June 10 regarding the guidelines that the Hartford should use in restoring redacted material. And the guidelines were not the small snippet of the trial court thinking out loud in the May 28th hearing that the Hartford has relied on repeatedly. The June 10 order is extensive, it's in our brief, and it lays out under Bertelsen and DM&E the standard. It tells the Hartford where you've got an attorney-client communication embedded in an activity log, first the Andrews log, and it would prevent plaintiff, the redaction would prevent plaintiff from being able to determine the basis of the decision and whether or not there's reckless disregard. You will restore that redaction.
But if
we use the same standard with regard to the other claims.
If I understand this correctly, though, they did then follow that direction in and unredact materials and resubmit them.
They provided us with another largely, closely similar version of the document to what they had given us before. Those, in addition to the three pages that keep coming up, those pages have been briefed and quotes tying it to the claim handling decisions brought to the trial court. So the trial court was able to see that whatever they had done after June 10 did not change the basic tenor of these activity logs. You still couldn't figure out the claim handling decisions or the bases thereof from the Andrews log, even with the key redactions supposedly restored. They actually went and did it the opposite way. If they say, we called Attorney Bob and that's all it said, they unredacted that. But if the claim handling decision that the adjuster made, supposedly, involved an attorney-client communication, it stayed redacted, and every important decision is redacted, even in the restored version of the Andrews log.
Was there an order on that?
The order on June 10 is the order.
All right. Was there another order on the matters that were submitted after the June 10th order?
The November 15 order. That is, we briefed that throughout the fall, and the court finally made a final decision on that November 15, following the ruling made in court on November 5. It was at that point, after the November 5 ruling, that the Hartford finally filed a motion for reconsideration and for the first time offered up the documents for in-camera review. And so the notion that these highlighted activity logs, the Andrews one, suffices as a privilege log, that's neither here nor there with us as far as the Andrews log. They claimed that we didn't need to do a privilege log. We used electronic highlighting to show. Well, that never happened with the other claim logs. They never offered that. They never suggested it, ever. So there is no privilege log in front of the trial court, and that's why the trial court said with no privilege log, it might just as well have said, and with no timely offer of documents for in-camera review, I don't know what anybody can do with this. So this notion of the record being incomplete, as this court warned litigants in DM&E and in Arnoldi, the question, you know, it's interesting questions about what happens if a trial court refuses a properly timed offer of in-camera review. But that didn't happen here. It'd be interesting to find out what would happen if plaintiff made that motion. Under what circumstances must a trial court accept, order an insurer to make that offer? But we don't have that either. What we have is Arnoldi and DM&E suggesting strongly, based on language from Wright and Miller, Federal Practice and Procedure, that the burden is on the litigant to create the record. It does not seem to suggest that the litigant does not have the tactical right to litigate it a different way. But you don't have much of a record. You don't have much of a record. We don't have much of a record if you litigate it that way.
And that's the problem. You're saying, as I understand the argument now, because it wasn't done timely, we're going to proceed without a full record under the assumption the privilege was waived.
We proceed on the record we have and
with a waived,
follow the order.
With
yes.
a waived privilege without any record of the unredacted documents being in the record.
I don't think the right word is waived privilege because I think the DM&E language is better, that these communications are outside the scope.
Okay.
I think it's an important distinction, but yes, the short answer is yes. And the reason is because the alternative is to craft an order, a ruling here today, that turns our attorney-client privilege procedure into a two-step one where you litigate to your heart's content until the trial court finally rules against you, and all that is an invitation to finally offer the documents for in-camera review.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Maloney, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Thank you. It's important to keep in mind that what we're talking about here are the electronic claim notes. That is one document contained in the entire. That's separate and different than the file. So you have the electronic diary notes that we're talking about here. In addition to that, you've got all the hard copies of stuff, the medical records that come in on a claim file like this, the attorney-client communications. Those things are part of the claim file. So to... when these claim notes, these log notes, are argued in isolation that you can't tell what happened here, that's taken in isolation without the benefit of the entire claim file and without depositions, okay? Andrew's entire argument upon this implied waiver is based upon a presumption and speculation of what was redacted.
But let me understand something. Don't the log notes require the company to have an explanation of its decision? And do these log notes, as redacted, can you tell what the explanation for the decision is in the redacted log notes?
It's not required of the log notes, it's required of the claim file, the entire file, and yes, that information is in the file. Regardless of which of the 200 files you pick out in the claim notes, some of them may or you may not be able to you may or may not be able to discern that from the electronic notes. But if you go to the claim file as a whole, yes, you can.
But how would the trial court know that without reviewing it, the whole claim file? Isn't that what would be required then of the trial court?
No, not necessarily, because presumably the only thing we're talking about are the redactions for the attorney-client communications regarding legal analysis. Okay? If the court reviews that in camera and says that it should be produced, and they the other party still can't figure out what happened. I mean, it's kind of a hypothetical process for figuring that out, because you also have depositions, you interview the adjusters. I mean, it's very clear what's going on here. You depose the adjuster. What's going on here? Where's that in your file? Oh, it's right here. And if it's not in there, well, where is that? Well, I was relying on advice of counsel. Then you have it injected into the litigation. But that's not, we don't have that here. That's never been done on any one of the 200 files at issue.
What is your response to counsel's claim that we're creating a two-step process here, allowing the company to stonewall, and then when they lose that effort, then you go back and say, okay, well, I'll let the court look at the unredacted materials.
I strongly, strongly disagree with that that characterization of the litigation. And I laid out the timeline, and the purpose of me laying out the timeline in my first 20 minutes was so that the court could see that this was a progression. We were waiting for the trial court to give us direction in reviewing the redacted version of the Andrews file that the court had had for 9 months. We never got that. And I also strongly dispute that there was any factual findings in that June 2013 order. What that is a 30-page trial court order that essentially reiterates black-letter law on the privilege. And if you look at it, everything is phrased that to the extent Twin City embedded information into the claim file, it should be produced, or if they did this. There's no actual findings on that. There is no indication in the record that the trial court did an in-camera review of that, of the Andrews claim file. All we have are these conditional findings in the June 2013 order, and then a simple legal conclusion that there was an implied waiver in November of 2013. I also wanted to touch on one of the comments too about the statements in Acuity, and that it is incumbent upon the party holding the privilege to get the documents in front of that. This may be a fine point, but if you look at Acuity, what the court says is that the party, and I'm reading from page 637, the party asserting a claim of waiver has the burden of establishing a waiver of a privilege. And it goes on to say that the party should get the documents in front of it. It doesn't say that the party holding the privilege, it's the party, presumably, who would have the burden of proof, which relates back to the earlier argument I made on that in my first 20 minutes. Regarding the injection of the issue of the privilege into this litigation, Mr. Andrews conflates injection of privilege into the physical file, the electronic file. He conflates that with injection of the issue of privilege into the litigation. And I think the question that you asked earlier about, was there a affirmative defense of advice of counsel? Was there a response to a discovery request that we relied upon advice of counsel? Was there a deposition answer that I relied upon advice of counsel? None of that occurred here. It's important to remember that that Twin City has done nothing more than deny bad faith. And then after denied bad faith, it has been in the position of answering hundreds of discovery requests about this $1 million list. And in all of them, it has not inserted the issue of the privilege. It has simply denied. Bertelsen makes clear in the three guiding principles, you have to presume, you begin the analysis with the presumption that there's a privilege, and second of all, that there is no to the extent there is a waiver, even if there is a waiver, it is only to waive the specific communication that is put at issue. So, you know, under South Dakota law and under Bertelsen, I would argue that even if there is a waiver, there is no such thing as a blanket waiver that as was put in place here. Even if there's a waiver, even if you find the first three elements of Bertelsen are met, which we argue have not been, you can't just say it's all waived. You have to review that and say, okay, this the issue is X, and this redaction goes to X. We will order that be unredacted. But this communication goes to a different issue. That should not be redacted. That's the direction provided in Bertelsen. And it is a cumbersome and it's a lot of work for the trial court. But the problem is that the discovery has kind of led us to this spot right now. I disagree that it is a two-step process. We made very clear from the beginning that we wanted the Andrews file reviewed. We had provided that to the court. As to the 199 other claim files, that is correct that those were not offered prior to the hearing on November 5th. And if you look at our motion for reconsideration, it was Twin Cities' effort to get that to the court and essentially saying, court, judge, we missed this in the hearing. We need to get this in front of you. We'd ask you to reconsider your oral ruling. And all this was done before the actual order was entered later in November. And then even after then, there was the motion to reconsider, which was denied. And I make that argument, keeping in mind, too, that, again, there legally, as a matter of law, there really shouldn't have been any need to review those 199 files in camera to begin with because of the first two prongs of the Bertelsen test. I've got 10 seconds left if there's anything else.
If not, thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here today.
The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.